Ta Elmer à la gestion des médias sociaux. Merci à Émile Perron et Katharina Villard-Morin pour notre site web. Et merci à Émilie Duchesne-Perron pour la transcription des épisodes.
Third World, and we're celebrating 40 years of reggae music. Keep listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Whoa, 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 yay! Them are the reggae ambassador. Hey, don't forget, CKUT 90.3 FM. Bonnie Rogue said that.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including Toronto CIUT, Winnipeg CKUW, Montreal CKUT, and Vancouver Co-op Radio, and featuring highlights in the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 66 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Support the community for just $5 a month and get a new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, it's another spectacular edition of the Harbinger Soapbox Series, live podcast recording and community event. But first, do you know Regeneration? Regeneration is a group of impact-focused students and young professionals fighting to open doors for the next generation of sustainability leaders. Regeneration is reimagining schools by developing action toolkits for student leaders across the country, repurposing careers by building development tools for students and young professionals who want to contribute to a more sustainable and just society, and remodeling companies by empowering young employees to create internal change and advocate for public policy that advances a regenerative economy. Formerly the Canadian Business Youth Council for Sustainable Development, Regeneration's recent manifesto changed campus discourse to shift towards a bold yet super professional approach to working towards building a more regenerative and just world, and building an economy that's distributive by creating prosperity for everyone, not a minority. Pluralist by recognizing there's no single solution. Just by empowering all perspectives and voices, particularly non-Western ones, and relational, acknowledging that everything's connected and that we're more than the sum of our parts. Regeneration's work in 2023 was really exceptional, and they built relationships with 90 universities and colleges, 420 youth orgs, 350 civil society organizations, 5,600 corporate sustainability professionals, and more than 10,000 students. So definitely check out their work and follow along with their new 2024 campaign at regeneration.ca. Back to the show. On this episode, it's another spectacular edition of our heroic Harbinger Soapbox Series live podcast recording and community event. This edition, Volume 2, Canada, What Are We Doing Here? Features your friends, 49th Parallel host Rob Rousseau, Nashua Lena Khan from Habib T. Please, and Tech Won't Save Us host Paris Marks live on Saturday, March 23rd at the historic Église Saint-Jacques basement venue Lennox, located on Rue Saint-Catherine in beautiful downtown Montreal, on the same day as the Brian Mulroney State funeral, which was happening a kilometer away, and the conversation talks TikTok bans, arrive can scandals, dollar store drama, and Israeli apartheid week. And that's all coming up in the next hour. Now, here's Rob, Nashua, and Paris.
Welcome to Harbinger Showcase Volume 2 with your pals, Rob Rousseau, Nashua Khan, and Paris Marks.
That's us, I guess.
Hello, yes.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. Let's see. We want to start with a thank you to our corporate sponsors. You know, they've been very generous to us this evening, sponsoring our event.
Yeah. Hey, did you two know that the weapons manufacturing industry, they don't just make bombs and weapons. They also do a lot of R&D. They're innovating a lot of interesting products and technologies. So we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss, you know, that's all. I think we need to keep that in mind.
This is why we need to give them a top billing, you know, at places exactly. Like South by Southwest, of course. You know, we also want to thank Lotto Quebec, you know, getting money out of everyone's pockets and presenting it as a good opportunity to, you know, be rich at some point.
and AHA, because that's what fuels Rob and I, apparently.
It's very refreshing. It's
carbonated water that's not Perrier because we're broke because of inflation.
I didn't actually know what that one was, I'll be honest. Yeah.
We're supporting it. We're supporting them.
Yeah, Imperial Tobacco. We're just all going to pretend that we smoke cigarettes. I don't know if you guys do. I don't.
Cigarettes aren't bad. They're from the earth.
Okay.
They're from the earth. They're from the earth. They're from the earth. They're from the earth.
Official.
Tobacco's from the earth. It's better than a vape.
Yeah, I'll say that. Okay. But seriously, our real sponsor this evening is Free Generation. They have helped sponsor kind of the audio and stuff for this evening. Nashua, do you want to say what they do?
Yeah, so Regeneration is an organization that everybody should look at. They're creating videos and other content related to climate justice, and we recommend taking a visit to their website. Maybe we'll peruse it later, and if you want to ask them questions later, you can talk to our friend right there, Maxim, from Regeneration, and we're really glad to see people working towards climate justice in more rigorous ways in creating audiovisuals, video, and other content that works as a way of popular education for the public. So check them out. They're doing cool work.
We love it. We love it. and of course, you know, we are your hosts, I guess. We'll be discussing these issues this evening. Nashua, who are you?
Who am I? we're gonna be brief about this because some of you know us from the internet or came last time, but I'm Nashua. I work in research and knowledge mobilization now, but my other hats are podcast creation, and I do some digital storytelling work, and I have a legacy podcast called Hibipti Please, where I used to explore, and I still explore in my writing, things from a lens that's a Muslim feminist lens, so it's kind of dirtbag lefty, but I look at things like Dune.
I just learned this.
Dune
I need to go
times.
Back and listen
yeah,
to these
gonna
episodes.
Do Dune. We're going to cover Dune next time. So I look at, is it actually Orientalism? I don't think so. There's some interesting fact. We should get contentious about it. Edward Said wouldn't be happy about that, using Orientalism for everything. But anyways, so Hibipti Please, that's me. And I'm a PhD student, which consumes my life a bit too.
Rob, who are you?
Yeah, I'm Rob. It's nice to see everyone here. I started a podcast called 49th Parahel back in around 2018. So I've been podcasting, and I got involved in... That's how I got involved in Harbinger Media and meeting Andre and meeting some of the fine folks that are part of this community. I'm really into live streaming as well. I got a daily live stream that I do every single day on twitch.tv for several hours a day. So I'm just a online goblin, and I just spend each and every day talking about this stuff and yelling and hooting and hollering online about all this stuff that we're here
all
to talk about tonight. Yeah.
it's a fun live stream. I've been on there as the official tech correspondent.
That's right.
Would that be
yeah.
fair to say, Rob?
Yep.
Okay, fantastic.
That's official.
I just gave myself that title, so it's official now.
And Paris, who are you?
Thank you, Nashua. I'm Paris Marks. I host a podcast called Tech Won't Save Us. You can see that we obviously have podcasting in common. I also write a lot about technology for a wide range of publications. And I have a newsletter called Disconnect if you ever want to read things instead of hearing me talk. But yeah, that is us. And we are all part of our podcasts, the Harbinger Media Network, which is a bunch of left-wing podcasts from all across the country. You might note mine. Which side would that be on? It was originally in St. John's, Newfoundland, but it has migrated a bit to the west from where it is right now. But there are plenty of other shows in the network if you want to check those out. Unrigged is also, you know, you've probably noticed that you can't share news articles on Facebook and Instagram anymore. It's tough to use those to get your news. This is a new website where a bunch of kind of independent and left-wing publications have come together to provide this kind of space where you can go and get a whole range of media from across Canada, from, you know, a bunch of different parts of the country. Yeah, and it's all there. It's really great. So you should definitely check it out. And so we're going to start with a little tribute to everyone's favorite prime minister right now, it seems. You know, I don't think he did a
single... Are we still doing the moment of silence that we had planned?
We certainly can. Let's begin with that. Apologies. Let's all put our hand on our heart like Ronald Reagan in this photo, and we can give a moment of silence.
Thank you for coming here instead of Brian Mulroney's funeral.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think you were all there earlier, right?
Exciting political event that's going on in this city.
Well, we can't even be silent. Okay, let's... brief silence.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
Why don't you start us, Rob? What's your biggest memory of Brian Mulroney, everyone's favorite prime minister?
Well, I think number one, this has kind of been an example of this kind of phony culture of civility that we have in our in this country, where you have politicians and media people from across the political spectrum all making sure that they pay their respects and everyone kind of making sure that they talk about how important this guy was. I think we're going to talk about, you know, the economic policies that someone, people like Mulroney championed. I think the thing that I was thinking the most of, considering, you know, everything that's been happening in Palestine over the last 6 months, the way that Mulroney has been held up as this kind of anti-apartheid figure. He's been held up as someone that, like, he was one of the first kind of Western leaders to come out against the apartheid regime in South Africa. He met with Mandela. I can let people decide for themselves whether they think that's justified or warranted or not. To me, though, I think that there's something about that that really whitewashes the role that the Canadian ruling class played in supporting apartheid up until the very last minute. And it's kind of used as a way, he's kind of an avatar that gives us a kind of cover or excuses the fact that Canada was deeply implicated in the apartheid regime in South Africa. So I think given everything that's happening right now over the last 6 months, I thought that was kind of the most pertinent thing that jumped out when we were seeing all these discussions about Mulroney in the media.
So I've been thinking about that, but I've also been thinking about his nepo children in media.
Yeah.
who look like him, which is like a little bit of a microwave dash and looking sad and constipated. But anyways, basically the other piece is that you have like Olivia Chow, who was championed by so many progressives and had slates saying, oh my gosh, rest in peace, he did so many good things.
Yeah.
Where the remnants of his legacy are seen in the Toronto housing market right now, all throughout Ontario, and our healthcare, why we don't have dental care, I'd argue, but also people like Jagmeet Singh stepping up also to be like, I need to send my condolences. Meanwhile, also doing land acknowledgements, and we all know Mulroney was somebody who stoked the OCA crisis, which is not far from here at all. And how about you, Paris? What are your memories, your fond memories of Mulroney?
Very, very fond memories. I was definitely alive during much of his
time. I know, I was going to say, were we alive? I don't know.
I think when I think of Brian Mulroney, like one of the key things, I think picking up on something that Rob said was, you know, there has been a lot of this kind of, when you look at the media coverage of Brian Mulroney and of his death, it's like all positive, right? You wouldn't know that he had a negative thing that he did during his tenure because you're not allowed to talk about this because this man just died. And I think especially when we're dealing with these very serious issues, it's important, especially for, you know, a previous prime minister like Brian Mulroney, that when he dies, that we actually have a conversation about his true legacy and not just kind of the good parts of the legacy or the parts of the legacy that can be cleaned up and kind of presented in a positive way, right? And so, you know, what Rob was saying about the, you know, apartheid, obviously, and his stance on that in South Africa, it's interesting that so many media figures have been able to point to that and say, look, Brian Mulroney was ahead of the UK and the US, yet they cannot kind of take that realization and then apply that to what is going on in Israel right now. And the fact that basically everybody in our political class is unwilling to acknowledge that what is happening in Israel, you know, that Israel is an apartheid state, right? But then on top of that is, obviously, we're in this massive affordability crisis where housing is ridiculously expensive across most of the country, where we're dealing with these serious issues in our healthcare system, and the kind of defunding of housing and of healthcare really begins with Brian Mulroney and the neoliberal transformation that happens under his premiership, right? You know, there's obviously the free trade deal, but it's not just that. He does massive cuts within public services to housing that are, of course, continued under Jean Chrétien when he becomes prime minister. But it's wild to me that we can have this discussion about Brian Mulroney and not mention those key things when they are so present in the political discourse right now. Yeah, I don't know if you guys want to pick up on
it. You'd think maybe there would be space in our discourse in either the media or with people in the NDP to maybe mention that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's what I was talking about, this kind of phony culture of civility that everyone in this country seems completely wedded to, where even politicians that are supposed to be representing those kind of viewpoints don't take that opportunity because people are going to get mad at them. It's going to be framed as being uncouth or impolite or whatever. But to me, it's like if you're part of that kind of movement and that's what people have voted for you for, that's what you're there to do, is to kind of make those criticisms even when it's going to be difficult, even when people are going to get upset about it. And it's frustrating time and time again to see people that have a kind of platform refuse to use that in those kind of critical moments. This would be a great opportunity to have some of these conversations, and it just hasn't happened.
Yeah, to have those conversations about the legacy of Canada and what it actually is and what, you know, our political leaders have done. So we want to move on to, you know, one of the kind of major issues that we'll be discussing this evening. You know, if you can't tell by the slide, we're talking about the ArriveCan app. Nashua, do you want to introduce this for us?
Yeah. So as somebody who has traveled a lot in the last 12 months, I'm very familiar with ArriveCan. I'm sure many of you are who've taken a plane since COVID. And the app doesn't fucking work. It doesn't work. You fill in the form, you get a barcode, then you have to scan the barcode or show somebody the QR code, whatever. It does not work. It simply does not work. It breaks. If you don't have a Canadian address, so you have a layover in Canada, you literally get stuck there begging people. I've witnessed this and been asked to use my address on a form. You literally get stuck if you're an American or somebody else who's like trying to get through in the airport. It doesn't work. It was an $80,000 bid from a contractor. And we're going to play a clip, and then I'm going to rant a little bit more about why Canada as a government seems fake because of this app.
This is a clip from my favorite
fake country. We're a fake country. Because where would anybody else get bamboozled like this? And I'm going to talk about how bamboozled we got.
And this is a clip from one of my favorite shows on CBC known as About That.
Yeah. Say that again for me, Rob.
About That.
Yeah. I love when Rob says that. All right.
So I'm not an expert in procurement and government contracts, but what this Auditor General report describes with how the ArriveCan vaccination quarantine app for travelers rolled out, it sounds like an absolute train wreck. A circus of train wrecks.
Overall, this audit shows a glaring disregard for basic management and contracting practices throughout ArriveCan's development and implementation.
The Auditor General found no meaningful, coherent partnership between the agencies involved. No evidence that the agency in charge followed its own ethics code of conduct. Per diem rates, on average, for outside contract workers, more than $1,000 a day. And the paper trail was so thin, the Auditor General couldn't even say for sure how much the ArriveCan app actually cost to make and maintain. And that's just what I learned by page 4.
It's good work if you can get it, you know?
Yeah, so the other things, today an article came out that the IT guy had his work from home office billed. This was an $80,000 contract. His work from home office was $2.2 million. It ballooned from $60,000 to $60 million. How does something go from $80,000 to $60 million without being audited until years later? And the app doesn't work. Like, if these people were actually using the app, I figured it out my first flight. I had to fly from Vancouver to Boston, and I got stuck in Alberta. And I got stuck in Alberta, and they made me fill it out, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, the barcode doesn't work. And the guy's like, no, it has to. And I'm like, no, it doesn't work. And he's like, it has to. And I'm like, the QR code doesn't work, man. Give me a piece of paper and a pen. Like, I was like, just let me fill this out. Anyways, we go from that. The work from home condo, $2.2 million. On average, a per diem for a company is $120 per day max. That's your breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then you have KM per whatever. And on top of all of this, the guy who got contracted works for the Department of Defense. And you're not supposed to get outside contracts if you work for the government. So I'm just setting us up for, we're clawing back on CERB. There was another article this week that came out where somebody's getting asked for $23,000 back. Chrystia Freeland is telling us, cancel Disney Plus. And we have these people getting $1,000 per diems. We go from $80,000 to $60 million. What do you two think about this? Because this is a mess to me as somebody who had to use this app, but also CRA is also coming for my ass this week in my taxes. And I'm mad.
I can relate to that, yeah.
Yeah, as a freelancer.
Yeah. I think when I think of ArriveCan, I think everything that you said is like so important to understand this app and also like how Canadian government works right now. Like, obviously, you know, we talk about COVID and how things were quite unique in that moment because, you know, things were just crazy and the government had to respond to this particular situation.
No one was checking receipts.
Exactly.
No one was checking anything.
But this is like a much deeper problem that is being, I guess, revealed or kind of put into the public consciousness because of this particular scandal and this particular app. I was talking to Rosie Collington, who wrote a book called The Big Con last year with Mariana Mazzucato, which looked into how in kind of governments around the world, there is this increasing reliance on consultants and on consulting firms like KPMG KPMG, and you know those kind of massive consulting firms like McKinsey that we're kind of used to hearing about, and how what we kind of have is the public service has had its capacity reduced so much over the past number of decades. Again, think back to Brian Mulroney and the cuts that begin under his premiership to really gut the public service and to gut the capacity of what the government can do, so that now you have you know, the government basically needing to rely on these private companies in order to deliver these services, to develop these apps. And we have, you know, we end up having these massive scandals like ArriveCAN because the public service can't do anything properly anymore. And it's a serious problem.
Yeah. How about you, Rob? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, it just speaks to this kind of culture of corruption that we have. like you pointed out, there's so many crises that, like, average people are facing here. And then you see this this nonstop flow of money going to this consultant class, this obsession as well with, like, the Trudeau administration, the liberals right now, with, like, innovation, and we're going to innovate this, yeah. And we've got, yeah, an app for this, and determining apps. Meanwhile, you know, nothing is really being done to address, like, the very real cost of living crisis that people are dealing with inflation, with housing, all these things the government can't seem to come to an agreement on. But when it comes to funneling millions of dollars to these useless apps and consultants, there seems to be no problem with greasing the skids and allowing that to happen.
Absolutely. I think that the other piece of that as well is when Rob talks about, like, the innovation that is happening, mm-hmm, or the desire by the government to promote innovation, right? And to show that everything is being digitized and, like, appified and all this sort of stuff within how the government works, is ArriveCAN was, like, one of those apps or one of those digital services that were introduced during the pandemic, and there was a lot of concern that some of these things might stick around, right? Like the vaccine, mm-hmm, passports and those sorts of apps and kind of digital tracking systems or what have you. All of that basically went away except for ArriveCAN, right? And this is the one that they have stuck around because it's not the one that you encounter every day out in society, but it adds this extra layer to what's going on at the border, right? So that they can get more information from you there. And it also kind of, you know, creates a further barrier at the border for people who are looking to cross it. One of the other things that happened alongside this, which, you know, a lot of people kind of don't really notice because, again, like, it's a border thing and we don't think so much about that, you know, because it seems like this kind of exceptional area. But along with ArriveCAN, there was this massive investment in the digitization of the, yep, border, bringing in these kind of smart border gates and all this sort of stuff, so that, you know, they're increasingly reliant on facial recognition and all these other tools that in, like, regular society we would generally be opposed to rolling out. But because it happens at the border, okay, that's fine.
It's, you know, a once-in-a-year thing if you travel once a year.
Exactly.
It's been normalized. The other thing is this revealed $5 million in other fraudulent spending. So while they're like, hey, man, can you give us $3,000 back from your CERB? You have a $2.2 million Ottawa condo. What kind of condo in Ottawa is $2.2 million?
Ottawa,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What condo in Ottawa is $2.2 million? I need to see. Like, what's happening in there? Is there a giraffe in there? Is there, like, a pool with a shark? Like, I need to know. I need to know. Are there glass floors
with
sharks?
We're helping pay for it, so we should at least get,
yeah,
the photos.
I need to know. We should all rotate and get a day in there, like a timeshare, yeah, because we all paid for that. I need a timeshare situation now. But when questioned, the guy who had got the $60 million contract with his buddy, he was just questioned on the 19th. So I find it super relevant because this all just got revealed. And an MP was questioning him, and they're like, yeah, so, like, you're contesting the report. Which part do you contest? And then he's like, I contest all of it. And they're like, did you read it? And he's like, everybody needs to watch this clip. It's on the National Post. Just use a paywall. And he's like, I didn't read it, but I believe my colleague. And they're like, you didn't read it, but you got $60 million and you're just doing this. And he's like, that happened. He's like, yeah. Anyways, I just think we should all get Disney Plus again.
Yeah.
That's the conclusion
the
of, yes, we should all
publicly
get Disney Plus again.
Disney Plus.
And stop using facial recognition and Face ID on iPhones.
Well, they seriously, we talk about, like, these programs that were put into place under the pandemic and, like, what was going to stick around is the vaccine passport. Maybe it would have been pretty nice if CERB could have
stuck around. Yeah.
Like, anyone that has ever, you know, if you've ever been on disability or unemployment or welfare or anything like that, you know the hoops you have to go through and the bureaucracy that you have to deal with. That was, I think, a really eye-opening experience for me and probably many other people in this country, how easy it can be for the government to just give you money at any time. The government just has this ability at any time to just make your problems go away. They can just press the button and they kind of choose not to. And you see how vital it was and important what it was to yank those programs back so no one gets any ideas about about the government being able to step in and help you pay your bills, help you pay rent, help you pay for your groceries. And meanwhile, we've had this whole like inflation situation, which Pierre Polyev talks about this like inflationary spending. He talks about
just inflation.
Inflation. Yeah. That's right. And they've kind of passed across this scam that it was things like CERB and these kinds of social spending that was leading to inflation and completely ignoring the greed that's inherent to that.
And ArriveCan.
Yeah, exactly.
And $60 million. You know what I would do? I would run a country.
Yeah.
$60 million. I'd run a country. But let's talk about running Dollaramas, though.
Yes,
absolutely.
Let's talk about running Dollaramas.
This Dollarama story is, I think, a really interesting story to talk about because it exists at this kind of intersection between corporate greed and half-assed climate policy. So we've got a clip. We've got a video here that kind of sets it up.
Dollarama customers could get some dollars back after the company agreed to a $2.5 million settlement.
The merchant must display the full price as opposed to a fragmented price.
The class action alleges the company didn't properly advertise the full price of some products, instead listing a so-called eco fee separately, catching shoppers off guard.
Just a couple of days after the lawsuit was filed, Dollarama immediately modified its practice nationwide.
Customers who bought batteries or battery-powered toys, light bulbs, or electronics could receive a gift card worth up to $15. Though if a lot of people sign up, that will reduce the amount per person. There's no proof of purchase required. Just submit an email address to the settlement website by April 5th. The settlement still needs court approval.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just a good example of the ways that, like every other crisis, the climate crisis has just been kind of used as this cash grab or this excuse to funnel money upwards to the absolutely most richest and most powerful people, whether we're talking about Dollarama using these kind of eco fees to price gouge customers, you got the grocery barons price gouging customers. Or the idea that like we're just transferring money to these like auto companies and EV companies rather than investing in public infrastructure or doing really anything that meaningfully lowers our emissions, which is what climate policy should probably be focused on. But in this case, it's just Dollarama has used this as an excuse to price gouge consumers, and now we can all get a nice little $15 gift card as a result. So the system works.
If you all submit, I want you all to. That's why I wanted this. Yeah. I want everybody to get $15, but don't tell your friends because then we might get like 10.
As soon as I saw the $15 like gift card offer, I was like, oh, so this is like bread price fixing all over again, right?
It's Rob Laws.
Yeah.
It's Rob Laws.
What do you think, Nashua?
I think, so my angle on this is that Dollarama has become like a staple. Like the Dollarama stocks have gone like this. Literally, they've done projections because everybody's so poor. So it's become normalized. Like there's mommy accounts now, mommy bloggers called like Coupon Cuties Canada and stuff, where they literally teach you how to make a casserole off of Dollarama grocery items instead of having like real groceries. And it's like normalized and feels dystopian. So it's like, yeah, we're buying our electronics at Dollarama. That's interesting. But also, like, why is it $1 to $5 now? It used to be $1 to $2. And then it became $1 to $3. Guys, if we don't
everything
fight this...
more expensive.
Yeah, guys, if we don't fight this in, like, as a public, we're going to be paying $10 in a few years.
With
for
your
a
$15
Dollarama
gift card, you can get three
yeah,
things
with, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, guys, like, come on. And I just don't think we should normalize... Like, Dollarama going up is a bad sign for our times because, like, why is somebody on Instagram going viral for making a four-ingredient Dollarama casserole with dried goods? It's scary. And I'm like, why is this going viral? Why is everybody like, thanks, queen. I can feed my family for a week for $10. I'm like, no, your kids are going to have scurvy. Like, I'm just worried about them.
I think it speaks a lot as well, like, that, you know, eco fees on such cheap products can become such, like, a big scandal mm-hmm. because it's indicative of the bigger problems where, on the one hand, you know, you have this growing inequality, so more and more people are poor so that more and more people in our society can be rich. So they become reliant on stores like Dollarama, you know, for the basics, but even just for food, of course, as we're talking about with, you know, when you talk about the TikTok videos, being able to put together a meal with Dollarama foods. And I think it points to the fact that there have been a lot of studies that show that, you know, when dollar stores move into communities, people often have less access to fresh foods because the actual grocery stores often end up moving out. But it also speaks to how you know, obviously there have been a lot of conversations over the past year in particular about Loblaws and about Sobeys and about the cost of food in general. So now you have people increasingly reliant on stores like Dollarama, where they can only get kind of these packaged foods, these processed foods, and you still can't get those fresh foods. And so it just speaks to this kind of circular nature of this whole conversation where people are getting poorer, they become reliant on Dollaramas, grocery stores end up closing, you have less access to good food, to fresh food, things like that, which people can't afford anyway because it's becoming so expensive. And so the whole society just becomes kind of trapped in this cycle of, you know, poverty, of malnutrition, that's probably the wrong word, but, you know, not having kind of the fresh, the good foods that you need, so you're not getting kind of the healthy meals that you require. And it just, I think, speaks to this broader problem in Canadian society that as much as our politicians talk about affordability, they're really not willing to address and actually deal with, you know, at the root of it, which would be addressing the deeper inequalities that are building in our societies that are leading to the reliance on Dollarama in the first place.
The eco fees also remind me of the carbon footprint thing, where it's like, calculate your carbon footprint online. Do you remember, like, in first grade? They're like, go online, calculate how much you're using, and then try to cut it down. And it's like, I don't know. I'm not Elon Musk. Like, I don't know. How much am I using? Do I leave lights on? Like, it's the eco fee is that, right? Just like, let's say it's the real eco fee at Best Buy, right? They're not fighting Best Buy. Like, okay, we're paying $1.25 extra on a wire we buy. Is that going to solve, like, the fact we had a really warm winter? We're not counting today, everybody. We're not letting this deter us from believing in climate change. Climate change is real. I heard somebody today on the street be like, there's no climate change. Do you see this? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Have you been around the rest of the winter?
There were shorts last week. Like, anyways, it's a bandage. But everybody should file their little PDF and send it over to this lawyer from Montreal.
Get their gift cards.
Get your gift card. And don't buy an electronic product from their food.
Yeah, and we were just talking about Brian Mulroney, and I think this whole, the idea of, like, Mulroney, neoliberalism, and now we're stuck in this future where this is the only way that we can talk about climate policy is using these kind of tweaks, these eco-taxes, or the carbon tax, you know?
A little nudge.
I think that's one of the most amazing, these market-based solutions, right? That's all we can think about is the market-based solutions and turning down these different knobs of spending and taxes, and that's going to somehow fix this massive crisis that we're finding ourselves in. I think it's really actually incredible that we're here. I mean, we're 40 years now having known about, you know, the effects of climate change. That's another, actually, while we were talking about Mulroney, he also got credit for kind of like being with the first kind of almost and only Canadian prime minister to adopt some of these green policies. But it's 40 years later here, and this is all we can ever talk about when it comes to climate policy, carbon taxes. We're still having this bickering over carbon taxes. Pierre Poilievre just tried to take down the government over this idea, and this is probably going to be a central premise to the next election. And none of these things meaningfully really impact the actual carbon emissions that we're putting out. I always like to point to China as an example at this time. You know, China obviously has a lot of carbon emissions because they're making all of our stuff. But at the same time, China, the last year, installed more solar panels than has been installed in Canada or the United States in the last 40 years. There's actually a process there to, like, meaningfully transition into a more efficient or more carbon neutral energy system. And here, 40 years later, we love to talk about, you know, how seriously we're taking this crisis. And Justin Trudeau, when he talks about this crisis and all that, how we take it seriously, but all we really have to ever talk about are these kind of like neoliberal pricing tweaks and taxes and stuff that don't actually really impact anything. And this is part of the reason that we're totally paralyzed right now and not really meaningfully doing anything to change the way that we're carrying on with our economic system.
Now, speaking of China and transition, we also wanted to talk about TikTok. Since people are making their videos about making Dollarama meals on there, it's become a staple for a lot of Canadians to get entertainment and meal advice, of course. But you've probably noticed that the United States is talking once again about banning TikTok and what that might mean, and you know, the big threat that is coming from China, or at least in the U.S. rhetoric and what they're saying. So we want to watch this clip. I'm going to stop it a few, you know, times in here because we have three of our most esteemed columnists and pundits in the country who are giving us their thoughts on whether we should be banning TikTok. So we'll stop after each one and kind of address their different points.
Althea, do you expect that Canada would go ahead with the ban if the United States completes theirs?
Yes, we will follow the American example, probably a few months too late, just like we did with Huawei. Hopefully it'll be months and not years, when the government hemmed and hawed and finally decided not to go ahead with the Chinese supplier on our 5G network.
So I love that. because it's,
I would
it's
love a Huawei phone. They look so really good.
My pop has one. To work pretty well. I think you can still get them in Canada, the phones. But I love that it's like, do you think we're going to ban TikTok? And immediately, yes. But also, not just yes, we're probably going to wait too long to do it, of course, which is just hilarious to me because it's not even like questioning whether, on the first hand, you know, the U.S. policy actually makes any sense and is founded on you know, real problems instead of just ones that the U.S. is making up to justify banning this competitor to its social media companies, you know, the first real one that it's had to face, not just domestically, but internationally as well. But also that, you know, of course this is something that we would follow after the U.S. to do. Like, why would we not think about our own interests, you know, our own national interests, what actually works best for Canada? Of course we just need to follow along with whatever they are doing. Any thoughts from you guys on this particular point, or will we move through them and then you want to get?
She has great hair, so yeah, she should love TikTok because TikTok is where you get really good hair tips, and she could become famous for telling us how she oils her hair. As a South Asian woman, you are prone to receding hairlines, and she doesn't have one yet. So she's using omelet oil or something, but also she's oiling and. TikTok would be a good space for her. So she definitely got bullied as a child or something because the response to that right away. She's also in the age group out of all of these commentators that would be the closest to probably using TikTok.
Yeah.
And so she's just like, no. She's like, no, like, we don't need, like, this is exaggerating. I was going to say geriatrics advising us on TikTok. But somebody hurt her because she right away was like, no, and we won't be as fast as we should be and we should follow America. She either wants to marry an American... I'm allowed to do gender. These two can't.
Yeah.
She either wants to marry an American. She either somebody told her something about her hair, or she just really loves Kamala Harris. That's my conclusion. Your turn.
I mean, I just think it's just you set it up perfectly, Paris, because this whole argument about TikTok is about this like dangerous Chinese influence in our society, and then when our professional pundits are discussing this, do you think we're going to ban this popular application because America told us to? Yes, right away. Yes. Then that's the discrepancy. We can get more into this later, but we want to talk about foreign interference when it comes to certain countries, but when it comes to America or Israel, then we don't really want to have that discussion about foreign interference in our democracy or electoral system or our social media applications or whatever it is. I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think just picking up on, you know, I will say... At the end of the interview, he asked whether any of them are on TikTok, and they're like, "Of course not. No, I would never be on."
No, because she got harmed.
Yeah, but I love your kind of repositioning of, you know, she would do great on TikTok because of her hair. It's like I think it speaks to, you know, the kind of content ecosystem that TikTok also creates, where it's like. This journalist would do great talking about hair on TikTok, you know?
I can say that. You can't, but yeah.
Okay. Totally. This is why we left it to you. Yeah.
I just have to say, too, before we move on a personal level, I've been trying to become a TikTok influencer for a couple years now.
You don't
unsuccessfully,
have the hair for it, Rob. Sorry.
Unsuccessfully. And I recently finally did a TikTok. The TikTok algorithm gods finally smiled on me, and I had a somewhat successful TikTok.
What was it about?
And now we're talking about it being banned.
What
oh,
was
that's
it about?
Interesting.
What was it about,
oh, that's
though?
Very interesting.
What
it's
was
only
it about?
Because
it was about,
it was about
people blaming immigrants for all their problems and like freaking out about immigrants and talking about the reason that, you know, groceries are more expensive or housing is more expensive or all these, the, you know, the climate, all these problems, it's not being caused by immigrants, it's being caused by the wealthiest people, and that right. you have peasant mentality when you blame the people with the least amount of power in our society rather than the people with the most amount of power. And then so I have finally a successful TikTok, and now we're talking about it being banned.
Well,
and
of course China would manipulate the algorithms
exactly.
to make that go up.
Yeah, so okay. just who benefits? That's the question. That's what we got to ask.
But Andrew, do you think the Canada Andrew, would follow next. The U.S. lead here?
Oh, without a doubt. It's not clear, of course, that it will be a ban. It may be that it's yep. a forced transfer, in which case a lot of the concerns start to fall to the ground. But this is at the intersection of two things that I think Western societies have been far too complacent about until quite recently. One is these determined adversaries in Russia and China and elsewhere. And second is the usefulness of social media in their designs, so whether it's algorithms that push propaganda messages or whether it's, in this case, the concern about privacy and using users' info against them or against our interests as societies. We've all had to kind of smarten up in a hurry on this. And so things that might have been shrugged at in the past, you know, people might say this is overkill or they're overreacting. I don't think so. I think this is there's clearly an issue here that has to be addressed. The Americans are, and we will have to follow their lead.
So the thing that I find fascinating about this response, right, is I don't want to give Andrew Coyne any credit, okay? But I think in general we are trying to grapple with, like, the impacts of social media, as he says, and we are trying to think about, like, the privacy elements of this. But his approach to it is so, like, okay, we need to think about these questions, but only in relation to TikTok and what TikTok is doing here, which is, of course, what the Americans are talking about all the time. But, like, we are in Canada, right? We are not in the United States. These companies like Facebook and, you know, Instagram and all these other U.S. social media companies that we've become dependent on are not Canadian companies. So when we're thinking about those things in relation to an app or a company like TikTok, why are we not also asking the question about Facebook and Instagram, especially yeah. as they're, like, banning news and, like, you know, are, you know, companies that I don't think we generally like very much. But when it comes to our, like, great national pundits who get to go on the national news every single week and opine about policy, it's not to question what the United States is doing or whether it makes sense for us to keep letting these U.S. companies do whatever they want. It's like, it's only a problem when the Chinese company does it, even though the companies that are also doing it are not even Canadian companies. Like, in the U.S., maybe you could justify letting all these companies steal your data and, like, whatever, because at least it's benefiting, like, the national economy and national security and whatever. But I don't see how you can justify that when they're not even our companies.
It's benefiting Mark Zuckerberg buying Hawaii.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know. He looks like a younger Mitch McConnell. His fingers are going to turn yellow and fall off soon. And he's going to have a stroke at a media conference.
Would he make a good TikTok star, Nashua?
No, because his hair isn't good. I'm sorry to the... It's true. It's why your first few didn't go viral.
I think so.
I'm kidding.
I think that's it.
You need to grow it out. No, I just, it's interesting.
You need to have luscious locks, yeah. Rob. Sorry.
It's interesting how they all fall in line with American understand. Like, their brain, they have two brain cells. They're like, America says yes, mommy says yes, I say yes. Daddy yeah. says yes, I say yes. That's my analysis of this.
Well, and it's really important to point out right now that we talk about this bill in America right now, which is a de facto ban of TikTok. Really what this bill does is trying to get TikTok's parent company to divest, which they're not going to do, so it is a de facto ban. But there's nothing actually in this bill that does anything meaningfully to protect people's data. I think that's an important thing to point out. If people in the United States government or the Canadian Parliament were actually interested in protecting people's data, there's plenty of things that they could actually do to do that, to protect our data, to protect other countries or different companies from having access to that. They're not doing that. Yeah. This is entirely like a sort of jingoistic effort to kind of like frame China as if they're like they're trying to destroy or influence our society in some way. And also on that level as well, not only do I not care if China has my data, I want them to have it. I want them to know that I'm one of the good ones. So when the invasion does happen, they know that I'm on board and that I can point them to people like Andrew Coyne and tell them where they can be rounded up for the re-education camps and all that stuff. I'm totally okay with that. So
they're not going to send the scary weather balloons over your house.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Okay, this she's going to be great. Right, our next one's going to be great.
Here's my follow-up for you, Chantal. Is like, do we have confidence that this actually is a security concern, or is any of this a trade concern?
I think it's more of a national security concern at this point. I think we've moved off from the everything that we're doing is trade-related, and China will retaliate or not. That's a game that we have been scared to play because we're smaller players. But I do believe that there are national security issues here.
No, completely wrong, right? I think this picks up on what Rob was saying, is exactly that it's not a national security concern, because the idea is, you know, that the potential concern is that China is going to get your data, or China is kind of rigging what you can see because it's affecting the algorithms, which ignores, first of all, that the Chinese government doesn't own TikTok. It's owned by a private company that happens to have, you know, a relationship to China, that happens to be based in China, but that doesn't mean that the Chinese government is putting its finger or its, you know, weight on the scale all the time in order to shape what's going on with this company. You know, if we talked about kind of Facebook and Instagram in the same way, we would think that's ridiculous. But of course, it seems totally fine when it comes to TikTok. And instead, you know, it's much more of an economic concern, right? Because we talk about how these U.S. companies like Facebook and Instagram and whatever else have had basically this monopoly on how many people in the West and many other parts of the world use social media for well over a decade now, and all of a sudden they are facing competition for the first time, you know, in their existence, basically, since the internet was privatized and since these platforms started to take over. And of course, you know, the U.S. government wants to stop that because there is an immense benefit not just to those companies but also to the U.S. government itself to have everyone using platforms that are run and operated by U.S. companies, and they do not want to see everyone move over to platforms that are, you know, run by Chinese companies now instead, right? And I think that that is much more important to understand, which also leads to the point about Canada, that why would we be pursuing the same policy agenda to ensure that U.S. companies can continue to have a monopoly on how we communicate online? It doesn't make any sense to me.
And I think it's especially relevant right now where a lot of people get their information from TikTok, and you see politicians and cultural commentators saying that, like, why are these young people so critical of everything? And it's they're sharing TikToks. TikToks are not stupid and silly. I know I was jokey about it, but they share information. They disseminate it very quickly. Same with Instagram Reels. They break down books that are complex, theoretical texts. They break down theory that's complex. It travels very fast. People can be auditory, visual learners. It's another medium that is making people aware of their conditions, their lives, and what a world could look like. And people have been shocked by, like, seeing, like, our trains fucking suck. The VRL fucking sucks. And you know what? Go on the train tag on TikTok. I don't even have the app. I've just seen it. Look at trains around the world. Doesn't that make you, like, what the hell? What the hell, liberal government? I could have that. That's just one example. Like, you could have a fast train. We have faster trains in Morocco. And people be complaining about Morocco when they go there. We have faster trains in Morocco. And you know what? A lot of Canadians figure that out through TikTok. That's or by going there and having a neoliberal, like, wet dream vacation. But I digress.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the most amazing aspects of this conversation. I don't know if you two heard that leaked phone call from Jonathan Greenblatt of the ADL talking about, we've got a TikTok problem. This is all
kids are learning about Palestine.
Exactly. it's this amazing disconnect from people that are thinking, like, oh, the young people are becoming pro-Palestine because of TikTok, because of these dangerous, subversive Chinese algorithms. And it's like the idea that young people are being radicalized by Chinese algorithms, which is ridiculous. They're being radicalized by the thing that's happening. And TikTok is just the avenue that they're using to share that kind of information and getting access to a narrative that is not ever talked about in our mainstream media.
And we can't view the news on Instagram.
Exactly. So it's like this is just the avenue that people have learned about this. It has nothing to do with the algorithm. People are being radicalized by Israel's criminality. They're not being radicalized by the devious Chinese algorithm trying to destabilize our society. I think another thing that I was thinking about when it comes to this as well is that, you know, when I scroll through TikTok, if we're going to talk about China again, I don't ever see, like, representatives of the CPC talking about the Belt and Road Initiative or anything like that. What I do see, though, sometimes is, like, rural Chinese people just hanging out and living their lives and cooking.
They're making tea and
being silly. Yeah,
beautiful pasture.
Exactly. And I think there's something kind of powerful about that. When our governments are out there trying to promote this narrative that this is a place that we need to be fearful of and we need to have, it's our adversary. I think there's something really powerful about being able to see people just going about their lives and seeing the things that make us similar rather than the things that that make us different. And I can't help but think that that's really what they want to prevent us from being able to experience or to learn about.
I love the videos where they make like the big pots of stew. Like
love those, yeah.
Or like the plastic bag stew. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
The plastic bag stew. Like innovation's there. Yeah. It's not an arrive can.
What
it's
is
there.
That bag though? That's amazing. Plastic bag technology is really
our stomachs, our Western stomachs, are not built.
Yeah,
for that.
I don't think so. I don't think we can do those.
But yeah, so we already see that the Canadian government has, you know, already been taking steps in lockstep with the U.S. government, banning TikTok from government phones, and also ordering a national security review. So they are kind of taking the steps to go down this path. And that leads us to the ultimate question: should Canada ban TikTok? What do you think? What's the verdict?
No, absolutely no. We will not follow in line with the U.S. I need hair videos.
You need Althea to start making hair videos. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, no. I'm trying to make it. I'm trying to be the next big thing on there. So, and absolutely not. No. I think it's just like a great resource, like we talked about for politics. You're talking about like hair care and stuff like that for cooking as well. I like to for that aspect of it. It's a really really valuable resource for all kinds of different niche sort of interests that you may have. So
the
idea
library.
That we're fixating on it so much.
TikTok's a library.
Yeah, it's
and
amazing.
Would we ban libraries if we were? TikTok's a library.
Yeah.
That's the conclusion.
I keep telling myself I'm going to start doing TikTok book reviews, and then I don't do it.
You are going
maybe
to
maybe someday. They're going to ban it the moment I post the first one. I think I would say that if we're going to ban TikTok, we should be banning Facebook and Instagram and all those too. There's no reason to justify doing one and not the other. So that's my take.
Well, and just the idea about the fear-mongering about China. I don't mean to fixate on this, but it is truly amazing. When you talk about tech, like there's so much Saudi Arabian money floating around the tech sector and Israeli money as well. It's not like there's this situation where, you know, in the tech community or Silicon Valley or where all these apps are being produced, that it's this like homemade, you know, American or Canadian thing. Like this is absolutely swimming in foreign cash. And it's amazing how we fixate on certain places, but we want to turn a blind eye when it comes to the real kind of foreign influence in this sector or other sectors.
Saudi Arabia literally posted that photo of a plane flying into the
CN Tower. Yeah, they threatened
to
do 9/11 to us.
They're cool with it.
Funny. It was kind of funny. Well, I'm sorry, it was funny. It was a little funny. Like, who did the graphic design there? I want to meet him or her.
I do. That was a power move. I mean, you have to admit.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was really
like,
power
we
move.
We were like, Saudi Arabia, can you please be nicer to the political prisoners, please? And they're like, we will do 9/11 to you. Like,
to the CN Tower.
We will.
What will Drake do after that?
I don't know.
Fall off the top of the tower.
So we are going to, I think, for the second half, dive into a bit more of what Canada has been, you know, doing on what has been going on in Israel and the genocidal campaign in Gaza that is still going on right now. And so we're going to start with a recent vote that happened in the House of Commons. Rob, do you want to get us started? Tell us what happened there.
So I was really interested, the angle about this that I was interested in kind of exploring this House of Commons vote, which of course led to we can maybe call it a ban on military exports to Israel. We can kind of debate about whether that's an accurate way of describing it or not. But this is the kind of question I had about this. You know, maybe Nashua, you would have some insight on this. But, you know, I feel like it's in my nature to be very cynical about this kind of thing. You know, is it too little too late? It's 6 months into this genocide that we've been seeing in Gaza. It's not enough. It doesn't go far enough. There was a lot of like negotiation that, you know, whittled down some of the language in this resolution, specifically about recognizing a Palestinian statehood. There's all kinds of things we can criticize about this. And be cynical about, and I think we should recognize that it's not enough and that we need to keep pushing and go farther. But at the same time, I feel like we should recognize that this is a big victory, right? It's a victory for the activists, I think, that have been forcing our political class to take a stand on this and forcing our political leaders to finally take some kind of a stronger stance on this. As we've been seeing over the last 6 months, our Liberal government has been fully not only, you know, supporting and endorsing this genocide, but funding it as well. So on the one hand, it does feel like a kind of a big victory. It feels like a historic moment where our government is kind of being forced, in spite of itself, to take this kind of a stance. So that's kind of the question that I had. You know, is this something that we should celebrate? Is this something we should be cynical about? Where's the line that we should draw about this?
Yeah, I'm kind of fuzzy on this because it's, yeah, it's like complicated, right? It's not like a yes-no thing, but I find this interesting because there's like a whole class of people who would be like, oh, these photos are misogyny. That's where my brain went. But I'm like, no, they're not misogyny because these people are complicit in killing women and children and men and everyone. So I just think about that kind of discourse of also Heather McPherson 2 months ago, who's pictured here, when people protested around Melanie Jolie's, outside of Melanie Jolie's second residence that we pay for. So we should all go there and timeshare it. But she's never there. She's too busy in Israel. And Jamaica, maybe.
Timeshares are,
anyways,
are
yeah,
it's, big on your mind.
I know, they're big on my mind right now. Anyways, she was one of the first members of parliament to be like, oh, outside of her house, how dare they? And it's like, are we not allowed to like throw a hypothetical modern day tomato at our politicians anymore who are complicit in genocide? Like standing outside her house, putting literal birds on a tree that had messages of peace and why we need a ceasefire, why we need to lift the siege, was considered violence by Heather McPherson, who ended up putting forward the motion and is usually the critic on global affairs. And it's interesting because it reminds me of the circling of wagons that happened around Mulroney, where like across the political spectrum, because he dies, everybody eulogizes him as a great human. So even at that moment when Melanie Jolie, because she's this like, frankly, like what she looks like is a big part of it.
That was another edition of the Harbinger Soapbox Series live podcast recording and community event, Volume 2, Canada. What are we doing here? Happens Saturday, March 23rd at the historic Église Saint-Jacques basement venue, L'Annex, in downtown Montreal. You can hear the full two-hour presentation at Harbinger Society Presents, wherever you get your podcasts, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. This episode of Harbinger Showcase has been brought to you by Regeneration, a group of impact-focused students and young professionals opening doors for a new generation of sustainability leaders. Check out their work and follow their 2024 campaign to reimagine schools, repurpose careers, and remodel companies at regeneration.ca. You can subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly updates on new episodes from Canada's cross-country community of 66 socially and politically progressive podcasts. Support our work for as little as $5 a month, and we'll send you a free new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing. Find out more at harbingermedianetwork.com. Stay tuned for another episode of Harbinger Showcase on this station next week. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Introducing Climate Organizing Shorts, a series of conversations to help inspire ideas for fostering change in your community.
That's genuinely what we're trying to do, is build power together as average people to hold decision makers accountable and get the basic things we all need.
Witnessing work is really big in a lot of Indigenous cultures.
You do not have to be a super serious revolutionary.
It's okay to make mistakes.
The joys of it are so amplified when you're in community with others, and it's easier to shoulder when you're standing side by side with others and not alone.
You can't build a foundation for a movement that's going to last over the long haul that is fragmented.
I sleep well at night. I don't have a lot of anxiety about the future because I know I'm doing something really meaningful.
Pick a fight with somebody. You are a climate organizer now.
Find Climate Organizing Shorts wherever you listen to podcasts.
Bonjour, ici Gilles Vignon. Vous écoutez la radio communautaire CQUT à ses 90.3 FM. Oui.
Spring into Action, Outrage, is happening March 11th through 24th.
Spring into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPIRG McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPIRG organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at QPIRGMcGill.org or on our Instagram at QPIRGMcGill.
Thursday, March 28th at La Sala Rosa, Orquesta Criminal launches a brand new album of criminal tunes sung in Yiddish, Bosnian, Greek, Arabic, Polish, Hindi, Spanish, Norwegian, and mixed Dengo. Orquesta Criminal is a gender-balanced 10-piece of improv performers busting out adventurous gangster songs from a dangerous and forgotten era. Thursday, March 28th, Orquesta Criminal's album launch at La Sala Rosa with special guests La Delegación. Tickets $20 in advance at casadelpopolo.com. Doors at 7. A co-presentation of Suenifero Popolo and CKET. Yay!
To someone else, there's always someone in the world that will listen. And if you can get everyone to listen, then it would be a better world.
That's right. That's right.
Sometimes I worry about this troubled world that I'm in. Sometimes I cry about the way everyone is treating me. But I'm going to move on down the line. I'm gonna take everything that I can. I'm gonna help the poor. And I'm gonna try to wait this weary land. I'm gonna move on. I'm gonna move on to higher ground. Cause there's someone that I can help in this world.
To like, I don't like anymore. I want a lot of other things I've never had before. It's just like my mama says, I sit around and mope.